Stay tuned for the Sunday morning wake-up call on 94.7 WPVC LP Charlottesville. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
And good morning, everybody. Thank you so much for being here with us today. It's a beautiful day, Eddie. And part of that is because you're here with us. Sid Milkus, our guest today, as of last week. Sid sent me an email saying, "Sorry, Rick. Important family emergencies that I must deal with. But you know what? If you call my friend and colleague, Ian McKee, he can cover for me, and he can do a fabulous job to talk about politics because he's also from UVA's Miller Center. Ian McKee in the studio. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me. Hope I can live up to Sid's billing.
Me too. Because you know how high my stress level went when I got that email on a Friday just before noon, when your radio guest that you spent a month convincing, you know, that he should return for like the fifth time over, you know, your 6-year friendship. And then I'm like, oh my goodness, it's not, you know, everybody who's, you can call on Friday before noon to say, hey, what are you doing in 48 hours? But Dr. Ian McKee here to talk politics today. Professor McKee, professor in presidential studies at the UVA Miller Center, received his PhD in American history at Cal Berkeley in May 2002, author of The Problem of Jobs, Liberalism, Race, and Deindustrialization in Philadelphia. At the Miller Center, Professor McKee works with the Presidential Recordings Program. Pretty impressive.
Thanks.
And you gave up an hour.
It's a fun place to be.
And you gave up an hour of your time to come here and talk politics.
Always happy to talk about politics, especially after the midterms.
That's right. And that's where we're going to start. We're going to start with looking back on the midterms. And of course, that'll take us looking forward on politics. So let's start with looking back, because shortly after the election of Donald Trump, our president, in 2016, everyone said the Democrats are going crazy. Look what this is going to do. All fired up. This is pretty much guaranteed a blue wave in 2018. Did that happen? Did we have a blue wave in 2018?
A couple of us have been joking around the Miller Center that we're banning the term wave in any analysis of politics, is I'm not sure what a wave means. We haven't defined that in true political science terms. My take on it is this: the Democrats did really well on Tuesday. Whether we call it a wave or a tidal surge or whatever other metaphor we like, it was a good night, a good day, and it fundamentally changes the political situation that we've been in for the last 2 years. The House, most particularly, is a really important win for the Democrats. There are a couple of disappointments in the Senate, although that was a really, really unfavorable map going in. A couple of governor's races still out there, of course. But, you know, and you look at this in historic terms, too, the probable point where the Democrats' gains in the House land are on the upside of what parties that don't hold the White House have tended to gain in midterm elections. It was a good day, really a very good day.
Was it what was hoped for? Because for, you know, and I'm far from a political junkie, but I read the news every morning. I follow what's going on a regular basis, probably on a one-sided basis. I don't read a lot of, I don't watch Fox News. I will read a couple articles from that side of the landscape. But it seems as though there was greater expectation, more victories expected or at least hoped for from the Democratic side than achieved.
You know, I think you can break it down two ways. There's sort of your ideal scenario. Beto O'Rourke wins in Texas. Claire McCaskill holds on in Missouri. The Florida and governor's races, Stacey Abrams and Andrew Gillum pull out wins. Those are certainly some disappointments. The truth of the matter is, though, that if you looked at this election coming in, whether it was a week ago or 3 months ago or 6 months ago, you would have said all those things are actually really reaches. And the fact that they were in play as much as they are is a testament to how much energy was out there, how well Democrats actually did. Then if you turn to the House, really the, you know, you always hope you're going to win 50 seats. But the realistic upper bound projections had it at about 35 to 40 seat gain for the Democrats in the House. It looks like that's about where they're going to end up. So, you know, in terms of any kind of realistic, pragmatic assessment of what the day was going to bring, this was pretty good. You always have those reaches that you hope you pull in. I haven't mentioned a state like Arizona, where it looks like the Democrat, Kristen Sinema, may very well pull that race out. That's a big win for the Democrats, both in shifting the balance on the Senate, but just to take a state like Arizona is suggestive of the kind of midterm this was. I feel that it actually, you know, short of that ideal outcome for the Democrats, this is a pretty strong result.
This is a Sunday morning wake-up call. Our guest today, Professor Guillen McKee from UVA's Miller Center. As we're talking politics, hard not to talk politics in the last couple of weeks, no matter how much you may like or dislike politics, with all the flyers in your mailbox, all the signs in your yard, unless you just pulled out your books and read your fiction. Hard to ignore what's been going on. So we'll do it last week and this week, and then we'll find a couple other shows to do. But thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
So let's keep going for a bit. You mentioned some specific races. Have we had more races so close that we're going to have recounts, or is this topic of politics just more in the news, and so therefore the recounts are just more newsworthy?
Well, you know, you look at a state like Florida, we've got a little bit of history there with recounts, I'd
right.
say.
Yeah.
You know, I think there always are some. The reality is, this is in much of the country, you've got some really closely divided contests, and that's going to just produce a number of them. And because of the kind of focus on the political situation, the ones that are out there are going to get attention, and in a lot of respects, they deserve it. You know, they matter a lot. Whether Stacey Abrams is able to pull out the Georgia governor's race, whether the Florida races break one way or the other, is going to have a significant effect. It's a natural thing right now, I think, that you have the attention to it. And given the level of just partisan divide in the country, you're in a situation where you're going to have some close races that hit the standard for a recount, whatever that might be.
What was the actual number of House of Representatives state seats flipped?
Well, there are a number of races, particularly I think in California, that are still uncertain. The official decided count right now is 32 seats gained by the Democrats, lost by the Republicans, with I think about 10 still undecided. With, you know, as I said, the projection at this point I've seen is that you're probably going to land somewhere around a 37 seat gain for the Democrats this year.
That's tremendous.
Yeah, it's a pretty good night. Just for some historical perspective, 1982, Reagan's first midterm, the Democrats picked up 26 seats. And we sort of think of that as a classic case of the party out of power winning the midterms. You know, you do have some cases on the Republican side where they had bigger wins. 1994, the Republicans picked up 54. 2010, 63. So it's not on that kind of a scale. But again, as you asked about our expectations earlier, you've got to look at the map of what's available to win going into an election. And, you know, 40 was kind of a realistic upper bound. If they end up with that 37, that's a pretty good targeting of where you could have ended up in your best case scenario.
So the GOP will lose more seats probably than during the Reagan administration.
Yeah.
And yet President Trump will probably claim victory.
Already did, I believe, on Wednesday morning. You know what was telling, though? You know, what does Trump do? Trump does theater, right? And so on Wednesday, he declares victory in the morning, and then in the afternoon, he changes the subject by firing or accepting the resignation at his request of the attorney general and fighting with the press corps. That gives you your answer right there. You know, that's the way Trump works. He's changing the subject, which he did very effectively in terms of what was being talked about by Wednesday evening, if you recall. That tells you that this was not a win for the Republicans. The fact that the president moved that quickly to do something that, you know, he didn't have to fire the attorney general that day tells you that he wanted to change the subject as quickly as he could.
Sunday morning wake-up call. Our guest today, Professor Guillen McKee from the UVA Miller Center, as we talk politics, still talking politics, unlike others, apparently, who have, or at least not talking the results of the election. Others and the White House have moved on to talk other bits of politics. 123 women elected to join the Congress in January. One thing I found interesting reading some of the analysis, only 19 members, female in Congress are Republicans, and that's actually down from 23. Why is this? What has made gender so biased in the parties? Why can't you be a female Republican
and win an election or get nominated?
Well,
a
female Republican politician,
yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah.
Why can't you get any money from the Republican Party to be a female Republican politician? Yeah. What is it? What's the problem?
Yeah. That's a fascinating way to look at it, because we tend to sort of say, you know, huge surge of Democratic women being elected. But you're right. There's a flip side to that, that the Republican Party is becoming even more male dominated. So it's an interesting angle to take on the question. I think you need to look at the kind of base politics, base in the sense of getting out their core base that the Republicans have followed in the Trump era. One way to think about it is that this is a politics of winning on a plus one margin. You know, you're not trying to assemble a broad coalition. You're trying to get one vote more than the opposition and win the race, starting with the presidency. And it's a strategy that relies on mobilizing a certain kind of voter. And the assessment, well, two things. I think the assessment that they're making in terms of the candidates that they're picking is that that's the kind of candidate that they're going to do best at that strategy. Secondly, for whatever reason, they're not getting female candidates to even go in to the nominating process to challenge an incumbent, perhaps, or to move into an open seat. So it's both a a selection and a choice issue. One of the interesting things on the gender balance overall is this sort of surge of women, both candidates and voters, for the Democrats is actually heavily interconnected with race, particularly when you look at voting margins. The African-American female voters breaking very, very heavily towards the Democrats right now, to some degree other minorities as well. White women are actually pretty evenly split, which is a fascinating angle on this. Shifted a bit towards the Democrats, but it's still, you know, relatively balanced. And yet that's not turning into successful female candidates for the GOP right now. And I think it does play into those kinds of elements of what the Republican electorate is responding to, or at least what the party believes they will respond to.
But what is that?
Yeah.
That's what I don't get is... It's almost as though, and I don't know, I'm just talking out of my ears. What percentage of the United States can the Republican Party get? Can you get more than 50%? People who are afraid of other people, because it seems to me that that's what they're marketing towards, because that's really what it's become now. It's a marketing organization. You're marketing to see who you can get to come buy what you're selling, and you're marketing fear. And do you have 51% of that or 45% of that? And what you're trying to do in so many ways is say, these other people are taking what you have, and you need to stay with me so that I won't let them take it from you. And the people who are in the Republican Party are the people who have everything now and are still voting for that so that they can keep it. That's my take on it, and mine only. I don't represent anybody else at this radio station, and I don't represent anybody but myself.
I think there's a lot to that. Certainly. And there's pretty much no question that was the closing weeks of the campaign, especially President Trump's closing argument, with the emphasis on the caravan and things like that to play the fear angle. I guess the short answer when we look at this election is it wasn't enough to close the deal. You know, that if you accept my argument that the Democrats basically won this election overall, it wasn't. Of course, there are some Senate seats and some governorships that broke the other way, where maybe it did at least hold the line. You know, when we dig down a little deeper into what's going on, nothing that really strikes me in this election, and we've seen it for a while here, is the level of division between rural areas and what I would call metropolitan areas, by which I mean cities and suburbs, that you have this really clear pattern now of larger growing areas voting heavily Democratic, including middle class and wealthier suburbs right now. And that's where, to the extent that kind of emotional fear-based appeal really didn't work. There's a deeper question we can think about in terms of the way place, spatial dispersion of people, and the way that shapes people's identities interact with some of those forces that I think are really helpful in understanding where the country is at this point.
Professor Gene McKee with us today as we're talking politics, looking backwards to the midterm elections, looking forwards as to seeing where these folks who were elected might take us in the future, 20 minutes after the hour. Hang tight. And we're back with Professor McKee, UVA's Miller Center, with us today on Sunday. Professor, you were talking about the metropolitan versus the rural center. Tell me more about that.
Yeah, you know, this, as I was saying, I think this is, to me, one of the most powerful forces in, driving American politics right now, and one of the striking features coming out of the midterms and out of the 2016 elections to some degree, or even back into the Obama years, that we really do see this divide. And what hits me with this is the degree to which where you live and the kind of people that you're around on a daily basis, not that these walls are, you know, completely impermeable or anything, but your general community, that place that you identify with, increasingly seems to drive people's political affinities. And more than their political affinities, it's really a matter of almost cultural identity right now. And, you know, I think that that determines a lot of answers in terms of things like we were talking earlier about why aren't there more Republican women winning office right now? You break down some of the way those community lines work and identities are understood. You start to see different understandings of gender roles. It ties into the way even things like the Me Too movement have been received. A fascinating thing with this is thinking about economics and race. You know, we had these kind of exhaustive debates following 2016. Was the Trump coalition about economic anxiety or was it about racial resentment? And, you know, people kind of talk themselves into a corner where it has to be either or. When the reality, I think, is this much more mixed bag of feelings of resentment, feelings, as you said earlier, I think pretty accurately, of fear of losing what I have. And that's a driving human motivation for a lot of people through history. Along with, of course, as we've seen here in Charlottesville, some, you know, flat out white nationalism, you know, that is out there as well. There's no question. The difficulty that I think is assessing how we can understand across that divide how the world looks. And one of the things that I'm struck by is we talk about it when we talk about race. You know, traditionally we understand that in sort of black-white terms, the civil rights movement. But now we're in a place where a lot of what Trump has been pushing, and many of the Republicans who have lined up with him, is around immigration. And there are elements certainly of race there, but they actually mesh with elements, rational or not, of economic anxiety. And it's really tricky, I think, to pull out exactly what the motivation of a particular voter or set of voters is in terms that we can increase very easily sort of boil down into these simplistic categories, when in fact it really depends on which angle, which component of it you're looking at. And what ends up driving that, I think, very often is that sense of identity, to group, to place, to who you are as a person and a voter. And that part, I think, works on both sides of this divide. You know, that if you're sitting in a metropolitan area, you see the world in one way, the way your life experience is driving you to see it, the way, you know, the people that you interact with more often than not on a daily basis tend to view it. And the same thing works in rural communities as well. And I should complicate this a little further. When I say rural communities, I mean generally smaller areas outside of the bigger metropolitan areas. There are certainly small cities that are lining up with the Republicans as well. Ohio is a great example of that. But it's that kind of identity that's shaping a lot of views around these issues right now. I hope that made some sense. Well, I'm trying to work through this myself as I think about it.
What it brings me to ask is, has it been more recent? Has it been further back? When did we as a country begin to vote more for the party and less for the person? Because we can see candidates from this midterm, King in Iowa, who has said some things that would be considered quite racist.
Absolutely. Yeah.
It was on the ballot this midterm. We certainly elected President Trump, who has some things that were considered in the past would have been considered of bad character. He has not gotten harassed by folks in his party to the same, if at all, and some things to the same depth and strength of behavior for his behavior that past presidents would have received for whatever party. And certainly others in their ballot, on this ballot, were elected despite the character. Corey Stewart in Virginia received many more. What do you get, 90% of the Republican vote?
That's about right, I think. Yeah.
So it seems much more about the party and less about the person. Yeah. When did that start to happen?
Yeah. Depends how you want to think about the question. You can make an argument that if you go back to the 19th century, which in some ways is the peak of party dominance, very strong parties, you have deep patterns of partisan voting in that period. It starts to diminish, I guess we would say, with the progressive era and more of a sense that it should be about the person or about the policies and ideas that they're pushing. But certainly, you know, if you go back to the realignments of the 1970s and 80s, maybe culminating, I would say, with Newt Gingrich and the Contract with America in 1994, tied to the deep antipathy towards the Clintons that the Republicans felt during that period. It's that stretch from the 70s to the mid-90s where something I think does fundamentally change, that you return to this deeply marked feeling of I'm a Democrat or I'm a Republican and, you know, I'm going to vote for that candidate regardless. And then that, I think, intersects, and this is what I'm trying to get at with the kind of cultural identification linked to place, that when you're in a community that either views what Corey Stewart says as completely horrific, you don't even consider crossing lines. And the reverse side, and this is where it gets really problematic, there's much more tolerance for ideas that are really troubling, that you can go down a road as a Republican in rural Iowa where, well, maybe what Steve King isn't really all that bad. You know, maybe he's a truth teller just like the president. You talk yourself into these votes, and it's reinforced by everything around you. You know, everything in your or maybe I shouldn't say everything. These communities are never monolithic. But many people around you are in the same frame of mind. They share that basic identity. It becomes socially acceptable to cast that vote. It's not breaking a norm in your community with the identity group that you associate yourself with. Your cultural affinity allows you to make that move. So it's a fascinating, I think, intersection of these questions of identity with a tolerance for things that, you know, you and I are going to agree are really, really problematic when we talk about a Corey Stewart or a Steve King. And that's kind of where we've gotten to today. So I think it's these intersections of forces that produce this situation. And I don't know how we get out of it.
That's something that I want to bring up next. Again, our guest today is Dr. Gian McKee from UVA's Miller Center as we talk politics 30 minutes after the hour. I did hear I guess I saw this on the PBS NewsHour, maybe, people talking about, some pundits talking about whether or not this election met with two or three others that they were calling this a generational election, as to how it fit in with the the turnover after Watergate, the turnover after the Reagan election, the turnover with the Newt Gingrich election. And they compared this in this manner. They called this the generational change because of the number of people change, the large and the disparity in the of women, especially in the Democratic group, the diversity, I should say, Native Americans, Hispanics, Muslims, gays, transgender, and both parties electing a significant number of military veterans, and the military veterans from both sides already forming a caucus, promising to work together across the aisle. Do you see significance in that? And do you believe that it might actually happen and hold with this keep and stick to your party format that currently stands?
Well, my nature as a historian is to always distress pundits the week after an election, which I guess I'm doing myself this morning. But so there's an answer of, we will see whether a trend that appears in one midterm is a lasting one. The other thing, though, as a historian, that I will say is that patterns that seem to be very fixed and very entrenched, like that kind of rural metropolitan divide I just talked about, can in fact be impermanent, that things can change really structurally and sometimes pretty quickly. So that's more of a, again, it's a we'll see answer, but it's change is possible. Another thing that's notable is, and particularly when we talk about younger voters, early political experiences matter a lot. There can be a sort of a setting of political identities, for one thing, but also of understandings of what the norms of politics are. And for people in their 20s, their 30s, these early experiences of the kind you're talking about, of a more diverse society, of less tolerance for the kind of racist or resentment-based appeals we were talking about a few minutes ago, openness to different kinds of candidates, maybe with the military caucus even breaking down partisan lines for, one notion of the greater good, those potentially can shape generational attitudes. So you could, out of these sort of shifts, actually see long-term change. So I very much would hold open the possibility that this is a generational election or maybe series of elections, because I do think you have to link a couple of these together, really from the Obama elections through 2016, through this reaction, maybe at least into what happens 2 years from now. But this is, I think it's pretty clear this is a powerful epoch in American political history that scholars are going to be looking at for a long time to figure out what's been going on. And, I think you combine this period and these elections together, there's, as the old song goes, there's something happening here, even if it's not entirely clear what it is.
You mentioned the age of the voters.
Yeah.
The age of those elected. I know that there were, you see the headlines. I believe the woman who's, I know she was Hispanic, of the woman in New York who was quite
Casey
young.
Cortez.
But the age of those elected, were they on the younger side, or were they more of the median age that we're used to?
Yeah. I don't know if I've actually seen any data on that, but my impressionistic sense is very much so that, a number of the candidates elected who have received attention seem to be younger, and particularly on the Democratic side, although not exclusively. There are a few younger Republicans coming in, too. I certainly get that sense. And particularly, I think if we look even in Virginia at some of the districts that flipped, the 7th with Spanberger and second, I guess, down in Virginia Beach with Elena Luria, women, but also relatively young. I think they're in their 40s, but compared to electing, you know,
compared
a male
to
congressman,
60-year-old,
yeah, exactly, yeah.
Suited and tied,
right, right. Yeah, it is a striking contrast in gender and in age, and to some
and
degree
Wexton?
Race and ethnicity.
Is that correct?
Wexton
B. Comstock,
right,
is
up
that
in
correct?
The 10th. Yeah, yeah. Again, not right out of college, but
right, still
relatively young in political terms. And of course, the other thing I'd say, and I think these, you know, those candidates are a really good example of this, is they really fit their districts well. You know, this is another thing that I'm taking away from these midterms. There's a lot of talk earlier in the year of, you know, whether the Democrats are going to fracture between, you know, socialists and centrists, or the Ocasio-Cortez wing and the Clinton wing. I think what we actually saw is the Democrats nominating candidates across the board who fit their districts awfully well. You know, and Ocasio-Cortez, she's perfect for Brooklyn, and she can then have a platform to push her ideas. Alison Spanberger, former CIA agent, I believe, running the 7th, that fits really nicely. Elaine Luria, former naval officer, nuclear engineer, I believe, perfect candidate for Virginia Beach. You know, and she captures the surge of energy among Democratic women, but she also is a veteran. You know, that's the kind of match district by district that you need to make to build a coalition, and then you practice coalition politics and figure out, you know, to cut deals. That's the thing I really take away from this, is that matching of candidates to where they're running rather than some kind of large scale ideological divide among the Democrats.
Well, that was one of the articles that I read, was that the Democratic Party needed to be aware of a divide. So you're saying that that's not necessarily the case, was that there were a fair number of far left wing candidates, but those weren't the ones that won, that the party had both what's the phrase? Let me find my notes here. Progressive, that there were more progressive groups and more progressive candidates were on the ballot this year, but those were not the ones that won. The centrist candidates were more likely to be the candidates that were actually voted in on the ballots.
I'm rejecting the whole idea of a left-centrist divide in the Democratic Party, which is not to say you're not going to have debates over, you know, do you want Medicare X or Medicare for All or Medicaid expansion? You're going to have these policy debates. That's natural. That's healthy. What I'm arguing is that where the Democrats did really well was where they matched candidates to districts and actually ran maybe not Democratic Socialists, but candidates that were able to articulate a progressive message that resonated with voters. And when you look nationally, I actually see a platform emerging for the Democratic Party around things like the minimum wage, Medicaid expansion, voting rights, maybe infrastructure, that doesn't require a left-center debate. You know, that there can be actually a fairly consensus-based and effective strategy around those ideas.
Again, our guest today, Dr. Gian McKee, is professor at UVA's Miller Center. Still talking politics.
Hard to get away from
two
today.
Sundays in a row. I'm so excited. I like doing this. It makes my early morning news reading worthwhile to carry it over on Sundays. Thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure.
A last minute fill-in for Sid Milkus. I hope everything's okay with the family. Sid, we'll have you back on another day. Be right back. All right, so I have a question for you, Professor
right.
McKee. So for much of the last 2 years, we have seen a lot of the Senate and Congress attached to President Trump. The few people who spoke against him decided not to run again. And then you either, I think President Trump made it quite clear in his mind, you're voting for me when you go out to vote. Now that the vote is over, midterms are over, you have one third of the Senate who don't need to be concerned about President Trump and their personal election anymore. They won't run again for 6 years, and whether or not President Trump wins in 2020 is irrelevant to them and their personal election again. Correct?
Correct, yeah.
We've already seen Senator Susan Collins from Maine step out and say she wants to put forth legislation or whatever the proper term is about saving the Mueller investigation so that it can't be shut down. Do you think that other senators will speak out or against or be more forthright against President Trump?
That's a fascinating question. I'm calculating the math here for the senators who are just elected, that they'll be up again in 2024, you know, the presidential election one term down the road. I mean, you can imagine where we're going to be, you know, when they run again, right? No one can make that calculation politically. So at a core level, you're right. There's a certain freedom there to, you know, express who you really are, for good or bad, I guess. I actually think, you know, I might have answered this question differently on Wednesday morning when it looked like Arizona, Florida, maybe even Montana were going to break to the Republican candidates for Senate, and that you were looking at somewhere, you know, 55, maybe 56 range or whatever that upper boundary was. We're now in this weird position where it could be anywhere from 52 to 54, 51, I suppose, if you think Mike Espy has a chance in Mississippi. I'm not sure he does, but throw that out there. The significance of that is that the power of a Susan Collins, a Lisa Murkowski, is immensely greater at 51, 52, than it is at 55 for the Senate Republicans, that their votes are badly needed, critically needed for the Republicans in a more narrowly divided Senate. You get to 54, 55, it's a fascinating picture because they're not needed, but they're also free agents. And then you have this other group of senators that, as you say, are actually untethered to a degree, at least in the short term, from the president. So the answer to this is, I have no idea how this is going to break. There are two things I would say in trying to get beyond I have no idea. One is that politicians tend to remember, even in a six-year term, who it was that voted for them and what they ran on. And at least initially, they're going to behave that way in office. And this is where you get the argument that the Senate has become much more Trump-centric. A lot of the people who won Senate seats did so by aligning themselves with the president. But events matter too. And if we reach a point where Mueller comes back with extremely convincing findings, and not just convincing to you or me, you know, or people in the, you know, the Democratic parts of the country that we've been talking about, but at least unsettling for a lot of Republican voters. If other events that we can't foresee intervene and their concerns about how the president is handling them, those senators, you know, have the potential to break with the president if events lead them to that. You know, if you think back a couple of years ago, you wouldn't have necessarily seen Bob Corker of Tennessee emerging as a critic of the president, or even Jeff Flake. So, you know, events are going to dictate a lot of this. I don't think it's set in stone which way it breaks between these two broad scenarios right now.
Why do you think that she stepped forward so early and said, you know, let's say, what do you think it all had to do with the actions with Jeff Sessions and what's the gentleman's first name, Mr. Whitaker? Matthew Whitaker?
Matthew Whitaker, right, right. That would be my guess.
She thought he was going to fire Jeff Sessions, install Matthew Whitaker, and Matthew Whitaker was going to immediately say, my first duty is to shut down the Mueller investigation.
I think the plays are not long-term, but a little longer-term than that. I don't think she expected that to fall by Thursday. I think it's more, again, you know, this degree to which, I mean, all politics is this way, but President Trump is really this way of trying to manage the news cycle. And as I said earlier, you know, the firing of Jeff Sessions, the resignation, I guess, technically, of Jeff Sessions was time to change the subject from a midterm that even by Wednesday wasn't going great for the Republicans. So that creates an opportunity for someone like Susan Collins to get her piece in there, to throw down her warning shot of, actually, you need to be careful because I may not stay with you, Mr. President, if you go down this road, or I'm going to take steps to prevent you from going down this road. And she's going to get the coverage as a result of that moment in the news cycle. So I think it's all sort of very calculated steps and political moves. I doubt Collins was trying to preempt a move by Friday to shut down the investigation, say. I think it's much more laying down markers, taking advantage of the coverage that was generated by the Sessions, Whitaker developments, and set the stage for what comes next, where she very well may be trying to build a coalition of Republicans who would be willing to vote with the Democrats on something like protecting the Mueller investigation.
And so how well-versed are you in constitutional law?
Passing, I guess. Not an expert, but one bumps up against it a lot in my field of work.
So was the installation of Matthew Whitaker legal?
You know, when you've got George Conway, Clarence Thomas, and John Yoo, you know, all lined up on the fact that this is taking presidential power too far, that's good enough for me. I mean, if those people are convinced that it's too far. Look, more seriously, well, actually, that is a pretty serious point. The fact that you have these critical Republican voices, and I realize Clarence Thomas, that was in a decision, a concurring opinion last year, in this direction, it does say that it's a serious question, very serious question. And, you know, if nothing else, and this is where thinking about the way this administration works compared to previous presidencies, the fact that this apparently did not occur to anyone in the White House before the appointment of Whitaker was made, it's not even, is it troubling when we know this is how they make decisions, that they do not think through all of the complications and consequences of these kind of appointments? Past presidents would have, somebody would have been there to say, you know, you need to think about how this relates to the appointments clause and the fact that Clarence Thomas wrote an opinion last year saying that you can't make this kind of appointment if the individual hasn't previously been confirmed by the Senate. You know, the fact that they didn't do that tells you a lot about how even 2 years in, this White House is working and not working. You know, is this going to stick? It's probably going to have to go through the courts to figure that out. My non-expert opinion on constitutional law is it's a pretty compelling case. A court will certainly hear it, and they might win. But, you know, again, it's the kind of thing, it's an unforced error by the administration.
But he already has the Senate. So even if it's denied by the courts, he can just put him up and say, well, all right, we'll go ahead and just approve him now.
He can, and that may work. But again, you then spend at least a couple of weeks, maybe a couple of months wrestling with this.
With his bad background, right?
When his background comes out, all of these things. And
for folks who are listening who aren't familiar with his background, toss out a few sentences on
Oh, boy, can I get it all? Let's see. He was on the board of a company that was, what were they doing, selling hot tubs or something, and there was fraud involved, and they were fined.
Weren't they stealing patents, too, or something?
Yeah, yeah, all kinds of malfeasance. I don't know if I can get it chapter and verse.
Right, but another court found the business that he was on the board of directors
of,
stealing from others, or but I mean, you know, he has he has a criminal background.
And it's the kind of thing that any other president of either party or previous administrations would have caught this in the vetting, and he never would have been appointed in a deputy position to begin with, let alone promoted to acting attorney general.
Right. So a guy with a criminal background is going to be the attorney general, or the White House wants him to be the attorney general.
And possibly unconstitutionally appointed. These are unforced errors. That's the thing. It's just, you know, whatever one thinks of the president, this is just, he's not helping his own interests by doing these kinds of things. And they haven't corrected this 2 years in.
52 minutes after the hour with our guest today, Dr. Guillen McKee, professor at UVA's Miller Center. A couple questions, again, going back to the results of the midterm elections and then turning around looking forward. Beto O'Rourke loses in Texas to Ted Cruz. But still, people are talking about him as though he all but won. They're talking about him running for something in 2020 in Texas, or maybe even as a presidential candidate. How is this possible?
It's, you know, he ran a pretty remarkable campaign, and he's clearly a great political talent. To come that close in Texas, where no Democrat has been competitive since, really, you'd have to go back, I guess, Ann Richards, statewide, is striking. And granted, Ted Cruz is a pretty problematic figure, even for Texas. But Beto's ability to speak to Texas voters, to mobilize progressive energy, to get new voters out, was really powerful. And the message and his capacity to deliver it, I think, was striking. And we saw some of the, even though he lost, some of the down ballot effects of his candidacy and his campaign were striking. The Pete Sessions losing his seat in suburban Dallas, for example, a couple of other House districts, things like judges in, I believe it was Greater Houston, with Democrats winning in ways they haven't in years, was really a consequence of his candidacy that needs more attention. So you've got this great political talent. Didn't win, but there's got to be a future for him, right? And, you know, I don't know which choice he'll make. I don't know whether he will be viable. Certainly think he's viable in Texas. Will he be viable as soon as 2020 in a presidential campaign in what will be a very crowded field? It's hard to say. And I think the Democrats are going to have to think very carefully about the kind of candidate that's going to be most effective against President Trump, not on a national basis, but given the electoral map that they're going to have to win in. You know, how does Beto play in the upper Midwest, in the Rust Belt, for example, which I think is going to be the critical battleground, or at least a major one, if not the determining one. I think it will determine it, actually. These are things going to have to play out. There's one warning I'll make about candidates like O'Rourke, and I say this with tremendous respect for him individually. There is a little bit of a danger in the way that Democrats, progressives generally, have been drawn to kind of charismatic, almost messianic figures around the presidency, and an assumption that if we win the presidency with this transformative kind of figure, it will solve all of our problems. We saw this to agree with Obama. We saw it a little bit with the Sanders campaign. We see some elements of it with O'Rourke as well. but we should be really attentive to what actually happened in this midterm. It was the activism and organizing energy of Democrats at the local level, as we said earlier, matching candidates to local needs and preferences, that gave the Democrats this win. And in terms of long-term change, that's where it's going to happen, rather than necessarily with a charismatic president.
So just a few minutes left with our guest, Professor Gian McKee from UVA's Miller Center. With the recounts that are going on now, Arizona, Florida, Georgia being the most noteworthy, or at least getting the most attention, and Republicans saying things being hacked, votes coming up out of nowhere, et cetera. I'm sure Democrats saying you're Georgia especially saying you're not counting votes fairly, or in Florida you're not counting votes at all. Are we about to see divides in whether or not races are always going to be questioned?
I think we're basically there. I think we've been there since 2000 and the Bush-Gore election. And when you have this tightly divided political situation, at least in many places, and you have high stakes and intense incentives for the parties to contest close elections, you're going to see it. What is disturbing, I think, is the willingness right now to challenge the validity of the right to vote. The challenges of the Supreme Court decisions on the Voting Rights Act, various efforts to make voting harder, and the way that's often targeted, let's cut to the chase, at minority voters. These are things that have a really ugly history in the United States. And this is something that needs to be a priority, to be pushing back against those kinds of efforts. And if that means some bitter fights over some contested elections, I would argue that that is essential to sustaining a strong democracy in the United States.
All right. Thank you so much for being with us today. Will you come back in the future?
I'd be happy to. Thank you for having me.
All right. Next week, Haas Spencer will be here to talk about his book. His title escapes me, about August 11th and 12th. Summer of Hate. Summer of Hate. Haas Spencer will be here next Sunday to talk about his book, Summer of Hate, those days in Charlottesville of last August. Thank you so much. Be with us then.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. The Wake-Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Strength is in their fuel. Engineering assistance is from Mike Friend. The Wake-Up Call is produced by Dan Gould. Show archives can be found at SeavillePodcast.com. Be sure and join Rick next Sunday morning for another edition of The Wake-Up Call, only on 94.7 WPVC.